Aloha. Welcome to The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. I'm Catherine Cruz. Cyber threats are abundant. Recent cases involve data breaches and large systems that affect our lives on a daily basis. We hear from the state's Office of Technology Services. We look at a competitive race for a seat on the board of the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, where two very experienced candidates will go head-to-head. Uncovering secrets in the Venice of the Pacific, what an ancient dynasty can tell us about modern-day sea level rise. And the Hawaii International Film Festival is in full swing here on Oahu. We take a look at a film shot on the Big Island. It is Wednesday, October 9th. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. October is Cybersecurity Month. Why should we care? Well, consider recent news headlines. Just the day before yesterday, we learned the largest U.S. water utility was hit with a cyber attack. American Water Works operates in 14 states, including Hawaii, and serves more than 14 million people. Here in Hawaii, it services Hawaii Kai on Oahu, as well as Waimea and Mauna Loani on the Big Island. Here is what customers hear right now when they call the company.
American Water learned of an unauthorized activity in our system, determined to be the result of a cybersecurity incident. In an effort to protect our customers' data and to prevent any further harm to our environment, we disconnected or deactivated certain systems. Currently scheduled appointments will be rescheduled as soon as possible. For relevant status updates, please visit amwater.com for more information.
Thank you for calling American Water. Due to system difficulties, we are only accepting emergency calls at this time. Thank you for your understanding.
And another example. Ticketmaster reported last month it was hacked, and customers are reporting problems now with concert tickets being taken from their account and resold. And in recent weeks, Times Supermarket and Don Quixote stores have been unable to process debit cards or publish weekly ads due to what its parent company called suspicious activity on certain systems on their networks. This following the discovery of credit card skimmers at Times Supermarket's self-checkout stands last year. This morning, we talked to Vince Wang about the attacks on larger systems. He's a chief information security officer at the state's Office of Enterprise Technology Services. Well, I'm sure to the bad guys, the information with these big systems are a treasure trove. But folks like you, you're the watchdogs, you're the guard dogs of these gold mines, you know, and so it's a lot of responsibility.
Yes. Like in one sentence, I've described my role and my team's responsibility that we need to protect our state government infrastructure and its data. That's a very concise way of putting it.
And so with this month being Cybersecurity Month, what is your department doing just to raise the awareness?
Our efforts statewide, first priority was coordinating with our Office of the Governors to issue a proclamation declaring October Cybersecurity Month for Hawaii. That is the overarching notification. And then within state government, we have several plans in place to help encourage and raise awareness for cybersecurity. Currently, right now, we're sending off weekly reminders on best practices. The way we provide that information is we roll out that information to our IT contacts across the various departments within our enterprise and ask that they then forward that off to their specific department staff. Another area that we're focusing on is coordinating some remote sessions to discuss various technologies and security. And at the top of mind, to wrap it off, we are conducting what we call a tabletop exercise. And with that, we bring in all the departments that we support, sit them in a virtual room, and work through a sample incident situation. And so we'll go through and identify an incident that potentially happens, and we work through the process on how to validate and confirm it's truly an incident and put in the appropriate measures on how to respond. In the physical world, we hear the term exercise, exercise, exercise. And this helps us validate the plans and procedures that we have in place so that we can more effectively respond to actual incidents.
And the state did have a hack, a breach, I believe it was last year. I think it was the Department of Health, right? The vital statistics?
Yes. There was a disclosure that the systems were exposed to the internet and there were some login practices that need to be refined, revised. And so we work with the Department of Health to identify what those controls are to be able to mitigate. First was to identify what the impact was and notify the family members of the deceased parties. And we put in identified technical control measures to immediately respond and longer term measures to help minimize the risk of future types of access. This pulled into a multi-year strategy for us to help enable and support citizen identity. And what we're trying to do here is that the various programs out there that are internet accessible to support our residents, we're going to tie them in to a common identity, single sign-on in technical speak, to help centralize that information so that we can better protect those sign-ins.
And that incident of the hacking, that involved death records, correct?
Correct.
Obviously, you worry about that because, you know, you don't want the bad guys using, you know, information, social security numbers, that kind of thing to create new identities or create, you know, new accounts.
Yes. In that particular case, there was an ability to create false records, but there were internal controls for humans to validate whether or not those were legitimate or not. So in the disclosure, it was access was made, but there were further controls to minimize the impact. It was a good warning shot for us to reprioritize and address some of the older systems so that we're using more modern identity methods.
We hear so much in the news about malware and ransomware, which can cripple, you know, healthcare systems or, you know, broadcast systems. And obviously in the case of the water utility, you know, people are concerned, well, will it affect, you know, the drinking water? Could they shut off those systems? Or is it just access to customers' financial data in those records?
All those theoretically are possible, but you have to prioritize by risk and the likelihood as well. So as far as the actual water systems themselves, at a high level, they're referred to as critical infrastructure, and there are layers, typically layers of control to separate them from malicious actors. When you're referring to the customer records, I think statistically that's more likely to happen there. And I think as we modernize the accounting systems for billing, then we'll be able to further provide those levels of protections.
When you think of these attacks, you often see that there is some part of the services that are shut down. In the case of the water company, right, you can't pay your bills online, and they're working to rectify that, you know, with Times and Don Quixote, right? They weren't processing debit cards. So trying to just maybe shut down systems to prevent, you know, more widespread damage, I guess. I don't know how much of these problems stem back to maybe equipment that hasn't been updated or modernized.
I would strongly agree with that statement. Typically, what happens is that we run our technology much older than in an ideal world because there are cost constraints on how to prioritize those items. As what you're referring to about the various systems being shut down, when there's a plausible attack, then that organization needs to make a risk decision on what should stay on versus not. And in many of these cases, decisions are made to take certain systems offline to minimize the spread of a potential attack. And I think that's a good practice. I think the largest issue is maintaining good communications with the public to help manage the concern.
And, you know, there was an effort, I believe it was under Governor Neil Abercrombie, right, to modernize our technology. I think back in the day, they were praising the technicians for keeping these old Wang computers, I think, in the Department of Education. But at some point, you know, you need to upgrade newer systems with better security.
Yes, strongly agree there. Systems that are current, we need to put in appropriate incremental work to keep them current. And then the older systems, we have to make a decision on whether it's appropriate to keep them running. And if so, we need to isolate them to protect them from potential attacks. The alternative is to do some research and modernization efforts and replatform. So in the case of an old mainframe, make the decision on when it's appropriate to move to a modern system, whether it be on premises, on island, or more and more in a public cloud where the systems actually live on the mainland and they're so survivable to against natural disasters, for example.
And I just wonder, too, about our physical vulnerability. You're down there in the basement, right,
of
one of our state buildings, and, you know, that's vulnerable to floods. But, you know, I don't know what other types of safeguards there are for the electronics, you know, if a lot of the data is in a cloud somewhere else.
Yes. Our office today, historically, there was a lot of equipment in the basement as well. And over a period of years, we've migrated most, but not all of our critical infrastructure into other facilities. In some cases, we're moving to state facilities. In others, where we didn't have that space, we moved to commercial facilities to ensure that there's an appropriate service level agreement to maintain that continuity. We have to weigh the balance between the physical controls versus the online internet-related controls. Newer controls tend to be subscription-based, and there's an ongoing cost, whereas physical infrastructure, there's a huge, huge initial investment to build out and then to maintain.
And are we in the process of switching anything out?
Our mainframe is no longer on island. It's in the middle of the country now while we're operating. Over 5 years, migrating to a payroll system, so they're off the mainframe. And most visibly currently is we're undergoing some modernization efforts to move off the mainframe onto a new financial management system. At a high level, it's being vigilant and asking yourself what you can do to help minimize impact to yourself. A lot of the conversations we talked about were focused very much on state infrastructure and the long challenges we have to be able to address them. But to tie it back to as a resident, like for me personally, for example, I'm aware that we have 3 credit card bureaus and 1 checking bureau. And it's making a risk decision that if I'm actively making accounts, I need to have access to those bureaus and they're not frozen. But if I know I'm not going to be opening accounts on the credit side or the checking side, make an effort to freeze them. That's a really good way of protecting, minimizing the risk of creating new accounts. However, a lot of effort needs to go into protecting existing accounts as well. And that really boils down to having good unique passwords wherever you can, use a password manager. And then where possible, enable two-step or multi-factor authentication to protect your personal accounts.
That was Vince Wong of the State's Office of Enterprise Technology Services talking to us this morning about Cybersecurity Month and best practices. The general election will pit 2 well-known veteran candidates for the at-large seat at the Office of Hawaiian Affairs. Here to talk about the race is HPR's Cassie Ordonio. Good morning.
Good morning.
So who are the candidates that we're talking about?
We are talking about incumbent Kaylee Akina and the veteran Leahu Isa, who was a Board of Trustee member serving from 2014 to 2022. And Kaylee Akina, you know, he's faced a crowded race back in the primary election. He went up against Brendan Lee, Peter Apol, Leahu Isa. But initially, it's now between Kaylee Akina and Leahu Isa.
And yeah, he is known to be a real watchdog of the Office of Hawaiian Affairs.
He is, and that's what he's been campaigning for. And Kaili'i, his background, he's the president of the Grassroots Institute of Hawaii, and he's been an outspoken critic of the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, and he even called for a forensic audit, which was eventually published in 2019, and it led to the Plant Moran report that also flagged some questionable spendings of OHA. So he really has been using that watchdog, and everyone can vote in his campaign. But Leahu Isa actually comes with a lot of political experience. Currently, she's a real estate broker. She was a state lawmaker from 1996 to 2002, and she was also a member of the State Board of Education from 2004 to 2012. So she kind of has that experience coming in. So she's not new to this political game or being on OHA. So I spoke with Jacob Aki, who's been a longtime political observer of OHA, and he says these two candidates are very different. They come from different backgrounds, different perspectives, but essentially he says OHA is a statewide race.
When Kili'i first came into OHA, he was really campaigning on trying to hold the agency accountable. When he got in, OHA was in the midst of a lot of investigations regarding trustee spending, trust fund spending. I mean, he really came in as the reform candidate, really trying to bring transparency and accountability to the agency. And as we look at the past 10 years, right, OHA really has come a long way in really being accountable and transparent of how trust funds are being spent. So I think really the impact he brought was he was that watchdog. You know, he did bring a lot of eyes and attention to the agency. And I think that's really his lasting legacy, if you will, and the impact that he left on the board. Leahu Isa, I'll be frank, I haven't been paying too much close attention to her, but she brings a unique background as well. She's a former state rep. She's a former member of the Board of Education. So she did bring a lot of elected office background. She brought in a lot of experience. But OHA is a 9-member board with 9 different personalities. So really trying to stand out is hard, and trying to get the votes you need to get stuff done is very difficult. You know, so I mean, in terms of what they've done, I mean, those are kind of the two that really stand out.
Yeah, but at least the voters know that they've got people with very deep experience.
They do, but the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, Jacob Aki, has said that it historically has low voter turnout, and there's no disaggregated data to say, like, who is Native Hawaiian who's voting versus who is non-Native Hawaiian who is voting. They just want the general public to vote, especially after the Rice versus Cayetano in the 1990s, to where instead of just Native Hawaiians voting, anyone who's a state resident here can vote.
Right, so we all should care and bone up on who it is that we want to cast our vote for. But so where do they stand on some key issues?
So When I interviewed Akina, Kaili'i Akina, he said if he's reelected, he wants to survey. He's pushing for a survey or tally accounting for all ceded land revenues. And many of the candidates want OHA to see more ceded land revenues from the state. And Ahu Isa wants to revise OHA's strategic plan by adding a fourth point of governance specifically. And when it comes to the issues of the 30-meter telescope and if it should be built on top of Mauna Kea, Ahu Isa says no, while Akina says he supports pono management of Mauna Kea as well as the construction of TMT. So both candidates say that there are pressing issues facing Native Hawaiians, which is housing, healthcare, and education. So that's something they do agree on. Aki says these candidates are running a statewide race and they do need to get their names out there. He says if Ahu Isa has been getting more of her campaign signs, which hasn't been happening in previous years, but Akina might have an advantage for how much he's willing to spend on a campaign.
In this primary election, he raised about $60,000, not as much as he was accustomed to in previous races, but still a large amount of money in a OHA race where candidates really don't raise anything. So I think if there's a advantage, the advantage does go to him because of the ability that he has to get his name out there. When you're driving around the island, when you're driving around the state, you see his signs everywhere. I'm in Hilo, I see his signs. I'm in Kona, I see his signs. I'm here at home, I see his signs. And when you're running a OHA race, that's what you want to do. People aren't going to care about the issues you are advocating for or the policies that you're pushing. All they're going to know is if I see your name and if I happen to go all the way down to the ballot and actually vote in this particular race, if I see your name so many times, I'm probably going to vote for you. You know, so that's kind of been his strategy, and I think it's a strategy that has served him well. Le'ahu Isa, on the other hand, I will say that ever since coming out of the primary election in August, I've seen more of her signs. Her signs are small, not as large as Kili'i signs, but I do see more of her signs. I was driving down the Waianae Coast the other week, and I saw a lot of her signs there. So I think she is increasing her game, but to the extent in which she can compete kind of on a ground game or even with the money as compared to what her opponent is doing, I think it's going to be very, very challenging.
So it is going to be a wait and see of the outcome this general election, which will be on November 5th.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Cassie. We've been talking to HBR's Cassie Ordonio with a recap of the OHA at large candidates on this fall's ballot. Find your stories online at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Photograph of a girl taken in Beirut has become a symbol of the strength of women in wartime. Rania Matar took that picture.
The girl looks like a phoenix rising out of the ashes. So it wasn't about the destruction behind them, but it was also about the sense of moving on and humanity and resilience.
A closer look at that photograph and what it tells us next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors, Bavarian Motor Experts, and Chaminade University.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Later this hour, we'll be bringing you a story from the island of Ponape in the Federated States of Micronesia. So fittingly, our backyard quiz question is about Ponape. Alexis Bachelot was born in France and led the first Catholic missionary group to the Hawaiian Islands in the 19th century. He was not exactly welcomed here. After being exiled from the Hawaiian kingdom, he sailed back to California. 5 years later, he attempted to return, but fell ill and died during the voyage. Bachelot was interred on a tiny island off the coast of Ponape in 1837. Over a century later, an expedition sailed to this small islet and attempted to recover his remains. But a 1997 analysis conducted by University of Hawaii at Manoa researchers found that the bones recovered were more likely Ponapean than European. For today's backyard quiz, we want to know the name of this little tiny island near Ponape where Alexis Bachelot was said to be buried. Call 808-941-3689 or toll free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right wins a reusable HPR tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing access to affordable housing to those with intellectual and developmental disabilities, including ARC of Maui County. NereidHawaii.com.
An ancient city built atop a coral reef. That's the story of Nan Madol, once the seat of a dynasty in Ponape. The site is of great cultural and historical importance, as it likely marks the earliest known example of centralized political power in the Western Pacific. A recent episode of a National Geographic show highlighted some of the open questions about Nan Madol. Here's a clip featuring National Geographic explorer Albert Lin from the show Lost Cities.
In the center of this massive body of water, the Pacific Ocean. Something incredible happened here about 800 years ago. In a seemingly unbelievable coincidence, two archaeological wonders just appeared in the Pacific. One, Easter Island, where seafarers erected giant stone heads. And the other, the even more enigmatic civilization that built a place called Nan Madol. A legendary complex of man-made islands and stone structures built right into the coral reef. That's where I'm headed.
Ever the adventurer. Now, Nan Madol was designated a UNESCO World Heritage Site in 2016. Here's Lin exploring parts of the ruins, construction from basalt stone and coral. He speaks with local historian Gus Kohler about the site's history.
This is it, Albert. Welcome to the jungle. We are on sacred grounds right now. You're just beginning to see part of the structures.
I've never seen anything like this.
Welcome to Nan Madol.
Only a tiny fragment of the legendary Saudalor city can still be seen. Mangroves choke whatever else remains. Now, new technology can help unblock the secrets of this place. How and why it was built, and just how big it really is.
What is that? It's incredible, isn't it? I was born here, but every time I come up here, I'm always amazed, always. This is the main ceremonial center of Nan Madol.
It's a temple to the island's ancient rulers, constructed from pillars of basalt rock. 800 years ago, this place would have been bustling with hundreds of priests, attendants, and the feared Saudalor kings.
It must have been some superpower humans to build this, huh?
Well, this area was meant only for the elite. It was the only time in our history that we were ruled by one person. Almost like a dictator, so he was able to command all the people on the island to come and assist in the building of Nan Madol.
Okay. Is that more rocks over there? Is that
yes,
more?
Yes, that's an outer wall. Built all the way to the edge of the reef.
Yeah, you can see the reef breaking right there.
Exactly.
It's massive.
And Nan Madol is spectacular. I have been fortunate to be there. One of the great mysteries of Nan Madol is what caused the downfall of the Saudalor dynasty. But new research has a surprising theory: climate change and sea level rise. River Shen is a geologist at the National Taiwan University. He and his team sampled over 100 corals that were part of the various Nan Madol structures, including the palace, the royal tomb, and the seawall compound. They were able to date a period of frenzied construction activity to the 1400s and found that the people of Ponape were building up the seawall just as the island's sea level was rising due to El Nino and La Nina events, a phenomenon known as ENSO variability. The conversations that Maddie Bender spoke with Shen about what Nan Madol's history can tell us about our ongoing man-made climate crisis.
Nan Madol is very big with over 100 artificial small islands we call islets. It, by weight, it is the biggest ruins in the Pacific. Western people contacted Nan Madol, Ponape, in the 1820s. And then during the World War II, Japanese people occupied there. And so they tried to figure out the construction history and also the rise and fall of the dynasty, Southern dynasty. but the exact history have never been revealed because of no any writing system. So the story, the truth and the story just passed by generation to generations. So truth became to story. Story became to legend. Legend became to myth. So nobody knows the truth, what's going on happened in the past. But the king, the oral history said that. The main chief forced their people to work for him. So people suffering, not for years, for decades, for generations. So finally, they fight. The dynasty just collapsed, just one night. So I thought that this is a good scientific topic to focus on. Yeah, so I and some collaborators from USA and also from Australia and Japan, we work together. In our lab, we can determine the coral because the structure compounds made with a basalt and also the inbuilt with the coral rubbers inside. We can date the corals. So we dated over 10 pieces per islet. And we collected samples from over 10 to 15 islets in total. So from the islet as the king's palace. And the important site is the royal tomb area. And also the breakwater, the seawall compounds. And then some islet, let's say local people said, this is a very original islet. So we collected coral samples from the important islets. We figure out the two main phases of the construction of this site is from 11th century. And then completely construction ceased in the early 15th century.
And that's surprising, but then you were able to kind of look at that and look at this climate data and say, okay, well, if this dynasty happened earlier than we thought, then maybe the El Nino events, climate change, could have played a role in the downfall.
Right. We didn't know that yet before we did a lot of analysis of our age distribution in this side, Lamando, and also the climate change in the past, paleoclimate records. After digestion, we find something special. And this is related to the sea level rise and also the ensoil variability. Because the island, Pohnpei, the capital of Micronesia, this island was formed with volcano eruptions. And then the island has been cooling, shrinking for tens of thousands of years. And then the sea level is rising with a rate of 1 millimeter per year over the past 10,000 years. And we figure out during the 14th and early 15th centuries, the ensoil variability is huge. So when the La Nina conditions strong, the wind will be from the east to the west. And then the wind can bottle the seawater to the western side. So the western side, the sea level is really high. Sometimes could be under a strong La Nina condition, the sea level could rise about 30 centimeters. And also the island is sinking with a rate of 1 millimeter per year. So combine the two effects, the seawater invade to the compound. Because the compound is located at the eastern side of the Pohnpei, facing the strong wind from the east.
And the sea level. And so you have, in the second period of buildup, you hypothesize that that is then them trying to combat sea level rise. And then they give up because the buildup stops.
Yes, because before the end of the complete construction, it lasted about 100 years. The king, the oral history said that. The main chief forced the people to work very hard every day, every week, every year to make the compound stronger. And then, because we collected corals, right, from the seawall compound, and we find at the end of this phase, over 50%, 70% of the corals used for the seawall compound to prevent invasion of the seawater. And then at the end, we realized this is exactly a symbol for what we are facing now, especially for the islanders in the Pacific, Indonesia, Indian Oceans. Now we are facing, because of global warming, the sea level rise over 3 millimeters per year. And then we also experienced a very heavy, severe insolvability. Combine the two factors, a lot of people, we call them climate refugees. Tens of thousands of people now have been moving to America or Australia. The key, I would say, we need to, for the human beings, we need to reduce the emission of the CO2 to the atmosphere as soon as possible.
Because if these island nations keep doing what they did 500 years ago with Pohnpei, of just building up the seawall, we can build as much as we want, but at a certain point, if we look at what history tells us, it won't be enough.
It's exactly right, but we are doing that. Look at the Miami and the New Orleans.
And Hawaii.
Coastal system. They're building walls there. If we don't stop this crisis of the sea level rise, so eventually all of the coastal zones will be underwater, seawater.
I think it's important also, people might see this study and maybe be confused of like, oh, how was there climate change back in the 1500s if it wasn't man-made? There is a distinction between natural climate change and these natural El Niño, La Niña events, and then what's happening now with man-made climate change. But we are experiencing sea level rise just the same as they were, but caused this time by us.
By us, yeah, by our human beings, yeah. I totally agree. So, of course, we have a Paris Agreement. So I would say the green energy is developing better and better now. We still have hope, I believe.
That was River Shen of National Taiwan University. He says another enduring mystery of Namadol is how the Pohnpeians transported all that basalt stone, tens of kilometers worth, to use in the construction of their palace city. His theory? They floated them on canoes. His study was published in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences Nexus. We'll have a link to it and photos of Namadol on our website after the show. Well, this is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. On today's Manu Minute, we've got the call of the o'u, thanks to the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology. This native bird hasn't been seen in the wild in decades, but scientists are holding out hope that its song may be heard again. Here's your host, University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart.
The o'u was once one of the most common of the Hawaiian honeycreepers across all the main Hawaiian islands, but was just recently declared extinct by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. It's about 7 inches long, with males having a distinctive bright yellow head and a brownish-green body, while females are duller and without the yellow head. Both sexes use their unusual parrot-like hooked bill to forage on a variety of native forest fruits, such as ia'ia, Ohe Mauka, and Ohawai. As one of the only frugivorous, or fruit-eating, Hawaiian honeycreepers, they're considered to have played a very important ecological role as seed dispersers across the forest, and would sometimes even venture down into lowland areas to forage on mountain apples, papayas, and other backyard fruits. The sweet, clear song of the male was a people's favorite, and it begins with a few distinctive whistled notes and ends with a series of downward notes known as a trill. Unfortunately, o'u numbers started to drastically decline in the early to middle 20th century, primarily due to mosquito-transmitted disease, and the last o'u were detected on Hawaii Island in 1987 and Kauai in 1989. Because o'u habitat is in dense wet forests not often visited by birdwatchers, there's still hope among optimistic biologists that a few of these birds may still be out there somewhere. In fact, there's been a handful of credible potential sightings in the past few years on the Big Island. New bird detection techniques, such as placing automated recorders across the landscape, or even using eDNA, may help us get an updated answer as to whether the song of the o'u will ever be heard again in our forests. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the UH Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Hawaii Forest and Trail, exploring Hawaii Island with visitors and kama'aina for more than 30 years. More information at hawaii-forest.com.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Jeremy Strong, who played Kendall Roy on HBO's Succession. In the new film, The Apprentice, he plays Roy Cohn, who was chief counsel to Joe McCarthy's Senate investigation into alleged American communists. The film is about how Cohn became Donald Trump's lawyer and mentor. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Furniture Plus Design.
Now it's time to reveal the answer to today's Backyard Quiz. Earlier we told you about the life and death of Alexis Bachelot, who led the first group of Catholic missionaries to Hawaii. After his exile, he tried to return, but he fell ill on the voyage and died near the island of Ponape. We asked you for the name of the small islet on which Bachelot was said to be buried. It is due east of Temuin Island and home to a couple of other important sites like a stingray sanctuary and a Japanese gun battery from World War II. We were looking for Na Island. Now, that island is filled with coconut palms and mangrove trees, and it is currently uninhabited, though it was once home to a powerful renegade Ponapean chief in the 1830s who took European whalers captive and used them as pawns in diplomacy. We had no winners today, but that was our quiz, and if you have an idea for one, send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. The east side of Hawaii Island is the setting once again this year of an indie film from a local filmmaker. It's titled Chaperone, and it was written and directed by Big Island resident Zoe Eisenberg. It was shot in Hilo and will screen at the Hawaii International Film Festival this month. It centers around 29-year-old Misha, a woman without much ambition in life. When she starts a relationship with a high school senior named Jake, he thinks Misha is also a high school student, but we see that her behavior becomes more and more reckless. The Conversation's Russell Subiono sat down with Eisenberg in our studio to talk about the film.
What I find interesting about the film is that it's a coming-of-age story, but it's not the kind of coming-of-age story that we're used to seeing on film. Why did you want to write this story? What were you hoping to examine or explore, or what kind of story were you hoping to tell?
Yeah, I guess for me, it usually starts with the spark or an idea. So with this project specifically, I often get mistaken for someone much younger than I am. And when I was 29, I was mistaken for a high schooler by a high school boy who asked me out to a house party. And I was like, oh, that's awkward. I'm old and I'm married. And we had a joint laugh about it and went our separate ways. But afterwards, I couldn't stop thinking, what kind of woman would have said yes? What kind of woman would have let that lie of omission continue? And what would her life have to look like? And what would she feel like she was up against in order for that to seem like a good idea?
And I feel like a lot of times, screenwriters, authors, I feel like a lot of times that tends to be the impetus of a lot of stories, is something that happened to them and they went one way and they thought, what would have happened if we went down this other path?
Yeah.
And you mentioned the lie, or the lie by omission, that Misha makes. Earlier this year, I went to a performance of Dear Evan Hansen at Manoa Valley Theater, and I think what was kind of lost in all the themes of the story is the idea of how damaging a lie can be.
Yes.
And it's not a new thing by any means, but it's interesting to see how we still see it pop up in stories. How did you go about exploring that lie?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the film is from Misha's perspective, right? Mm-hmm. So we're, you know, I call her a very unlikely predator. And I think it's easy to be on her side because I understand her, even though I don't agree with her choices. But I am very much aware how a lie like that, which is a deep betrayal for a person that she's building an intimate relationship with, is going to have larger negative consequence for Jake than it really is for Misha. Even though Misha does get her comeuppance, it's funny, we've had some parallels to Evan Hansen, which I haven't seen before. But, you know, there are definite repercussions for Jake, and although there are some more like physical, tactile repercussions for him, those are really just to kind of pull to the forefront the deep emotional scarring that he's going to have, because this is his first real relationship, and for his first real relationship to be one built on just deep betrayal is going to stay with him for a really long time.
I'm a Gen Xer and a parent, and as I was watching the movie, I saw the movie through my lens, and it seemed to be a story about somebody who's rebelling against responsibility and accountability, but I imagine that different generations or different age groups might see the film through a different lens. What do you hope your audiences see in your film?
Man, I don't know what I hope they see, but I know what I was feeling when I was working on it. And, you know, it's been interesting that a lot of the feedback for Misha is that, oh, she's a slacker, right? And this is kind of a slacker film. But in my perspective, she's not a slacker at the start of the story. She's not ambitious. So it's really, for me, a look at the weight that our culture puts on ambition. She's held the same job for 12 years, which for me is success, even if she isn't interested in upward mobility. She has the deep privilege of family inheritance, so she's not worried about day-to-day cost of living. And so that impacts every choice that she makes. And so for me, the real problems in her life actually begin when she feels so judged by the people around her who don't really understand her self-satisfaction, that she starts to make destructive choices, because it's such a relief to feel accepted and, in her opinion, seen by someone. Because when Jake meets her, he thinks she's great. And Misha thinks she's great. And no one else really thinks that she's great.
I'm glad you brought that up, because that was something that ran through my mind. We do live in a culture that has such pressure and such expectation for our young people. As I'm watching Misha in the beginning, I also see somebody who's just happy. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody who's satisfied.
Sometimes I feel like you do not take this place seriously.
Are you joking?
No! God, you've been doing box office for what? 12 years?
How is that not serious?
Oh. It's like your life plan is, I just don't want to die. And I just feel if you applied yourself, you could do some real good here.
I am applying myself. I'm sorry, Kenzie, but I don't want to be in charge of people or deal with scheduling. I don't need the pay raise, and I definitely don't want the stress. Can you just please accept that already?
We are drowning here, Misha. And we are drowning, and you are just watching!
I also felt like there's nothing wrong with her. Yeah. She's just fine. And so was that something you were also maybe pointing at, is just how much pressure we can feel from others in terms of how we should be living our lives?
Definitely, yeah. And the way that judgment can weigh on our psyche and our behavior when we don't feel like we have a true sense of community, because every time she's in a situation with the people that she loves, they're pushing her to be someone else.
Let's move to the technical aspects of the film. You shot the film in Hilo. I was very impressed with the cinematography and the coloring, because I felt like you made Hilo look like it could be any town in the U.S. And I feel like you weren't trying to push that it was Hilo or it was Hawaii in anybody's face, even though there are plenty of identifying markers and landscapes. Did you write the story that way, or did you intend to shoot it that way so that it had a more universal feel?
Yeah, I did. Okay. And also, you know, a lot of our stories here are heavily showcasing, you know, the scenery of where we live because it's beautiful, but that's not really what the story was about. So I did want it to feel like it could be a sleepy, small seaside town anywhere.
Yeah, and I really did feel that. There's some shots of Hilo that kind of look like a sleepy Midwestern town, but then when you see the coast, it does look like it could be, you know, somewhere along the Northwest or the Northeast actually as well. At the same time, you did showcase many places in Hilo and along the Hamakua coast and Hilo coast that I hadn't seen in film before. Can you talk about how you were able to balance the universal feel of the story, but also showcasing Hilo?
Yeah. I mean, honestly, that comes down to practicality. And with a small film like ours, with a very small team, we're using the resources that we have. And I'm lucky enough to be deeply involved with the Hilo community and with a lot of our local business owners. I myself am a local business owner. My husband manages the Hilo Palace Theater. So when I was writing this film, I was like, all right, well, you know, what are the places that I love that I have access to, but that I also want to showcase?
Hilo Theater, Island Naturals.
Island Naturals, yep.
Yeah.
Turn the Page Bookstore. Yeah.
Oh, very cool. I've seen many independent and student films, and I know that sometimes, a lot of the times, the score is one of the biggest facets of filmmaking that is hard to get right. For your film, Taimane did the score.
Yeah.
And she did an incredible job of capturing the mood and the tone of the scenes. Can you talk about why you chose her and how you were able to get her on board?
Yeah, we approached her really early in the script stage because I love Taimane's work. And I had seen another indie film that I was like, you know, this film is great, but my favorite thing about it is the score, who did this. And it was Taimane, and her work is just so elevated. It's just, I can't say enough nice things about her and the way that she can set a very unique mood and tone, and the way that she actually naturally likes to pull in outside elements. So when she created some of our score and our original track, she was using Cokie Frogs.
I noticed that over the ending credits. Yeah.
Yep. She was using cat sounds very subtly, but it does come through and it creates this really beautiful tone. And she's just so wildly talented and creative.
As a native Big Islander, I am not a fan of the Cokie Frogs, but for a few seconds as I was watching the ending credits and I knew that the call of the Cokie Frog was integrated into the music, I thought, oh, that's kind of cool.
Yeah, well, you know, the way that I, just from a creative standpoint, was looking at Misha is sort of as an invasive species once she enters this world of Jake in high school that she doesn't belong to. And I was trying to look at it from the perspective of an invasive species, which is, you know, I have no natural predator here. I am the natural predator here in a lot of ways. And so the Cokie Frogs, there are also orca whale sounds that Taimane put in some of the tracks as well, which were just kind of like playing with this predatorial element.
Earlier this year, another film that was shot in Hilo at her feet had some screenings around the state. Your film will screen at HIF in October and November. What are your thoughts on the Big Island getting more representation in film?
I think it's really exciting to see film expanding to the Outer Islands. It's hard to shoot anywhere in Hawaii, and it's especially hard to shoot on the Outer Islands. We have such minimal resources, but we have a lot of talent, not only the people living there, but the actual film community, and most of them are going to Oahu to work. So it's been really, really wonderful to see more opportunities coming up for us at home.
Your film is Chaperone. It will screen at HIF next month. Can you share with audiences how they can see it?
Yeah, it's playing on Oahu on October 10th, and it's playing at the Hilo Palace on November 10th, which is very special because it's playing in the theater it was filmed in. The projectionist who plays the projectionist in the film will be screening the film. So it's just a really special experience.
Does the AC work at Palace Theater?
They have AC now, but now the complaints are it's not strong enough. So, you know, it's a constant battle.
Okay. Well, Zoe Eisenberg, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thanks, Russell. Thanks for having me.
That was Big Island filmmaker and author Zoe Eisenberg talking with HGR's Russell Subiono. Her film, Chaperone, again, screens on Thursday, October 10th at Consolidated Theaters Kahala as part of the Hawaii International Film Festival. It was also screened at the Palace Theater in Hilo on November 10th. We'll have a link to more information on our website later today. Well, we're all out of time now, but tomorrow we plan to assess the state of childcare in Hawaii, why researchers say soaring costs have led to a crisis. Got a story you'd like to share? Leave your feedback on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Find the conversation as a podcast on our website or on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.